We hope no one will consider the self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NapaClub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, we had a change in speaker. And Debbie O, who's got a great track record here at NAVA, she's going to save the day for us. So I'm going to let her find her passage. You ready? Whenever you're ready. Y'all welcome Debbie O.
So, I'm on. Okay. I was not expecting this. So, anyway, here we go. I usually start out telling what my sobriety date is, and I came in March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, 1997. And what it was like, what happened, what it's like now is how we tell our story. So I'm going to take some deep breath and kind of calm myself here. I always ask God to speak through me. It's not about me. I'm up here telling my story. My story's my story. And if any of you have not told your story before, it's certainly an experience getting up here. And if you have heard my story, I apologize in advance. And if you haven't, well, here goes. I was born in a little town called Galax, Virginia. And it's up in the mountains. It's in the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains in the southwestern end of Virginia. It's right on the North Carolina-Virginia border. And neither one of my parents are alcoholic, but my mother's father was an alcoholic and my father's father was an alcoholic, and they grew up in pretty alcoholic circumstances. And so they became, of course, adult children of alcoholics with really no tools and just doing the best they can. But the town I was born in is a factory mill type town, textiles and stuff like that. And my mom worked at a knitting mill called Haynes, and my dad worked at a knitting mill called Wonder Knit. And you know, their income was, you know, pretty minimal. And so my father, well, through my mom's brother, my father was able to get a job at General Motors. So in 1965, we moved from Galax to Duluth, Georgia. And we moved into, at that time, it was on Pleasant Hill Road. The only thing on Pleasant Hill Road, believe it or not, back then, y'all, was a truck stop and a trailer park. And I didn't live in the truck stop, so guess where I live. And we lived there for until I was 12 or 13. And I had a pretty normal childhood. I always, you know, I hear people share that they always felt different. I don't know that I always felt different. I know I didn't get along well with others. And, you know, we always had, there was a lot of kids in the trailer park. I mean, we had little trailer park gangs, and, you know, we'd be all over that place. It was huge, huge trailer park. So we'd be in the woods, digging, you know, and, you know, down playing right by the lake, riding our bikes. It was just a different time back then. You know, you could just, I'd walk out the door in the morning and I wouldn't come home till dark. And we'd play all day long and play hard. And, you know, there was always a pack of kids playing. And, you know, I thought a lot. And I had a sister, too. She's 11 months younger than me. And we were either sidekicks or we were fighting. And I know I felt different in school. And probably if I know, when I started going to school, if they tested kids back then like they do now, they probably would have diagnosed me as like ADHD or something, because I could not sit still. It took me forever to learn anything. I just had a different learning style than the average kids, you know. So I struggled in school, And that, I think, added to my low self-esteem. But like all good alcoholics, we learn survival techniques. And so I can remember at an early age, you know, like copying other people's homework and, you know, trying to get by like that and cheating. And I was a pretty good sneaker. I didn't get caught. And so that wasn't a very good lesson for me either, because sneaking was became a kind of a big part of my story. And so we went on through I went on through elementary school and middle school, and we finally got out of that trailer park. My mom called it the cracker box, and she wanted out of that trailer, and we finally built a house in Duluth in a place called Cardinal Lake. And I went to Duluth all 12 years. I went to elementary, middle, and high school. I graduated from Duluth High School in 1978. And my first drink I was probably about 13, and I don't remember getting drunk, but I remember kind of acting out the part. Me and about four girlfriends got in my dad's liquor cabinet and just poured just a little bit of something out of every bottle and put it all in one cup, and we all passed around and drank it. And of course, we didn't get caught. And then my first big drunk was in high school. The Duluth Wildcats went to state, and I was in the Flag Corps. And I don't know if y'all remember George Rogers. He was a Heisman Trophy winner, and he graduated a year before I did. And he led our team to some big wins, and we had a good football team back then. And I was in the Flag Corps, and my sister was, I think she was a drum majorette that year. If not, she was playing in the band. And so we went to Statesboro. I think we went to Statesboro to play for the state tournament. And we ended up losing, and one of the girls from the drill team knew this guy that was old enough to buy liquor, and he bought us, I think, a pint of tequila. And so, you know, we were back off to our hotel room, and she and I were sharing the tequila, and I really don't remember a whole lot of anything after that. After a few drinks of that tequila, I was in an immediate blackout, and my sister, God bless her, was doing her very best to clean up behind me and try to get me sobered up enough before room check rolled around, before our band director came around and made sure everybody was in their room and everybody was being good. And so she got me in bed, and when our band director peeked in, she said, "What's wrong with Debbie?" You know, they said, "Oh, she just went to sleep early. She was really, really tired." And so I didn't get caught. And the next day I was so sick. Oh, my God, I was so, so sick. And didn't think I ever wanted to drink again. But it wouldn't be too long. I think I was about 16. So it wasn't long after that I was drinking about every weekend. I got in with Duluth. I mean, my graduating class was 99 kids. I knew everybody, had gone there my whole life. And so, you know, a lot of us, we'd go up to Lake Lanier to this place called The Rock every weekend, and we would drink. And there was a store on Buford Highway called Whitey's and Eddie's, and Whitey would always sell us. They never carded us, and I know Whitey and Eddie knew I wasn't of age. But you could get the gallon draft beer. You just get a gallon milk jug and stick it under the draft beer thing, you know, and be on your way. And I say that I started drinking pretty much alcoholically by the time I was 16. But through all that, I did graduate high school, and I went to West Georgia College in Carrollton. And that really made my drinking career take off, because, you know, I had a little parental supervision. My father always worked second shift at GM, and my mom was a workaholic, so she was never at home much. And me and Becky pretty much, you know, raised ourselves as far as that goes. But, I mean, nothing against my parents. I have good parents. But they were always gone. And my sister and I were pretty wayward. And so anyway, I went to West Georgia, and I made it a year. Oh, my gosh. I was at West Georgia with two or three girlfriends, for one thing. And we ended up getting in an upperclassman dorm where you had your own entrance and exit. And, you know, we had our own bathroom, which was unheard of because, you know, most people have to share bathrooms. There's a bathroom and a dorm room and a dorm room. But we had our own bathroom, and that bathroom kept a keg in the tub most of the time. And got into other substances that, mostly marijuana, you know. But I didn't make it through. I mean, I passed everything, but I failed volleyball of all things. But and I barely passed anything else. But I just realized I was not college material. It just wasn't for me. So I ended up quitting college and going back and living with my mom and getting a full-time job. And I started working on Spring Street in downtown Atlanta at a place called, at the time it was called General Communications. And then it changed its name to GenCom. And then it went to AirTouch. And now it's Verizon. And it was the very first beeper, pager company and cell phone company in the Atlanta area. And if you can believe it, at that time there was only 198 people could have a cell phone. That's it. And I had 2 and 3 year waiting lists for people wanting to get a cell phone, and they installed, we would schedule installations, and it would take a half a day to get a phone installed in your car. And we did beepers. They had the voice beepers and the tone-only beepers and the vibrator beepers and all that stuff. And I worked on the side of the company that did add-ons and repairs and scheduled mobile installations. And I had full control of pulling up people's accounts and how many, you know, you get 50 free calls, and anything over 50, you got to charge 7 cents a call. I had full control of the waiting lists and things like that. So if customers were nice to me, I would either out the call count, or I would put them to the top of the waiting list, or, you know, that got me concert tickets, and it got me, you know, $100 beer here, $100 bill there, and so I wasn't fair to that company. I was also a kid. I mean, I'm not trying to make excuses, but I was 19 years old. And but I stayed with the company for a long time, but I was going out every single night. We lived, me and a couple of girlfriends lived in Sandy Springs in an apartment, and I don't know if y'all remember Packets right over here at Northeast Plaza. I just about lived at Packets, and so every single night we were going out. I would go to work hungover. How I kept that job, I don't know. So I decided I would have my first geographical cure, and so I thought the perfect place to go for me to settle down and behave like a nice young woman would be to go back up to Gay Lights, Virginia, where there's nothing to do. And there was, I mean, there's literally nothing up there, but everywhere I go, there I am. And they got even better stuff up there called moonshine. And anyway, I got a job there at a bank, and I became a teller, and I got in with this crowd that liked to horseback ride. So every single weekend we would go horseback riding, or we'd go on wagon trains, or, you know, we would horseback ride every weekend. And I was a little bit scared of horses, but as soon as I got some liquid courage in me, I'd crawl up on one, and there we go. And ended up meeting the man that would be my first husband. And so he pretty much drank like I did, and it was a, you know, pretty volatile, abusive marriage. And you know, we fought like cats and dogs, and it just, you know, was not a good marriage. But I ended up getting pregnant and having my first child. And I stayed with him until Rachel was almost two, and then I had my next geographical cure, and that was to leave him and come back to Georgia. And so I moved in with my mom, and I started working for her company. And I had my, I fell in love right away, of course. Got back down here to Atlanta and fell in love again, and it went long before I got married again. And thank God that one didn't take as long for me to realize it wasn't going to work. So we were married about a couple of years, and I got out of that marriage and kept working for my mom's company and doing well, but all along trying to have a child, trying to have a social life, trying to work full time, and I was also to supplement my income. I was cleaning offices, and I cleaned a couple of houses. And I saved up enough money to get accepted into a program that would that offered government-funded money to build, you know, your first-time homeowner to build a house. So I ended up building a house and moving out to Auburn, Georgia. And all along trying to balance my drinking and my social life and working full time, and now having a house with my little girl. And so I don't know, I think having a child helped me be a more, if it makes sense, a more responsible drinker. I mean, once I had her, when I drank before I had her, it was like no holes barred. I didn't have a lot of consequences of my actions. I never got a DUI, I don't know, because I had multiple car accidents that I was definitely drinking. But I think it was just the times. I started going to bars when I was 16. You know, cops would stop you, ask you if you've been drinking. You say no. They just take you on your word. So, you know, I should have had some DUIs, and I should have gotten into some more trouble. I should have had some more repercussions of my actions, but I didn't. And I, you know, everything happens the way it's supposed to. When I look back, I think, you know, if I'd have gotten some trouble, maybe some serious trouble, maybe I'd have gotten here sooner. But I got here when I got here. And so anyway, I ended up living out in Auburn for about a year and a half, and I met the man I'm married to today. And I knew he was different. He didn't drink like I did. And I can remember having this sinking feeling like, you know, David, he doesn't drink like you do. You know, how are you going to get by with this? But then knowing that I'm a good sneaker, you know, I just didn't think of, you know, I didn't think too much more about it than that. And that was about 3 years after I had divorced my second husband. So I had three years in between marriages, and I had, you know, moved up in my job. I'd built my own house. I was, you know, everything was looking okay on the outside, but I was still drinking alcoholically. And so we got married, and in 1993, I had a son. And Randy would go to work. I would get Sarah off to school. I would get John off to his parents' day out program. Then I would start drinking. And something inside was saying, you know, something's not right about this. You know, I'd shut all the blinds. If the phone rang, I'd tell him I wasn't home. You know, she's not here. May I take a message? and I would drink probably a six-pack or a bottle of wine, and then I would sober up to go get my son from his parents' day out program and stay sober long enough to get my daughter from her elementary school. And then by the time my husband came home from work, I could open a glass of wine, because we were wine-drinking buddies, although Randy is not an alcoholic. But I would have wine readily available when he would come home from work, and I'd have supper cooked, and I would already probably, you know, had two or three glasses unknown to him. But and I'd probably drink a bottle half a night, and then get up in the morning and do that same crap all over again. You know, it was just day in, day out. And we always had New Year's Eve parties. And one night, my oldest daughter was 11. And I was really, really drunk. And she was up later than she should have been. And she was talking to me, and I was so drunk I could not. Have y'all ever been so drunk that you slurred your words to the point that nobody can understand you? Well, that's how bad I was. And so the next morning, she called me out, and she said, "Mom," she said, "you were so drunk last night, I couldn't even understand what you were saying." She had tears in her eyes, and she says, "That just scares me. That scared me so bad." She said, "Will you please not do that again?" And it just, you know, it just got me right here, because I thought I was hiding. I thought I was hiding all this stuff. Now, what I know now is I wasn't hiding nothing. And kids are so much more attentive than what you think. So anyway, I started really looking at my drinking. And I told her I wouldn't do it again, and I ended up doing it again. And my cousin, who lives in Virginia, her husband was driving right along this time. Her husband was driving and had her son in the car. And cop stopped him, and he got a DUI. And DFAC got in on it. And, I mean, I don't know if it was DFAC. Anyway, whatever Virginia has, where the children's services. And I started thinking, oh, my God. You know, because how many times do I get in the car and have a couple of glasses of wine with my kids in the car? And this could happen to me. My kids could get taken from me. And, you know, all these things, you know, rolling around in my mind. The yet that hadn't happened to me yet. And so I got up one morning, I was hungover, I got everybody out of the house, and I was just, so I was sick, and I thought, what am I going to do? Am I an alcoholic? Is that what is going on here? And so I pulled this flyer out from a church I've been going to, and I opened it. You know how you're desperate, you're looking for some kind of answer outside of you, you know, please give me a sign. So I pulled this flyer out and I opened it up, and I went, my honed in right on this article that said, do you drink and periodically find yourself drunk? Well, if you do, this is the seminar for you. And I went, I mean, it was like, oh, this is a sign from God, you know. So so I knew that I was going to go to that seminar. And I knew one of two things. That at that seminar, they were going to teach me how to drink right. Because I was a control freak. I mean, I never swore off alcohol. I hear in the rooms all the time people saying that they quit a million times. I never once swore off alcohol. Now, I'd be so sick I couldn't drink for 2 or 3 days. But I never swore it off. I was going to do it. I was going to get this thing right. No matter what. No matter how long it took. I was going to get it right. I was going to figure this out. I was looking for that sweet spot. And I could not hold on to that sweet spot for like over 10 seconds. And I'd swing over to the other side, or I'd be on this side trying to control it. And then I'd be pissed off because I wasn't drinking how much I wanted to drink. And so I figured this seminar was going to tell me how to do this, or I was going to find out if I'm an alcoholic. So I ended up going to the seminar, and the guy was promoting a book he had written, but he was also an advocate of a 12-step program called AA. So, and he recommended a sponsor, he recommended working the steps and so on and so forth. So, because I had been going to church regularly, been going to women's retreats and things like that, there was a woman that sang in the choir with me that every women's retreat she would get up and just give just a little tidbit of her story about, you know, her experience with alcohol and alcoholism. So the first thing I did was when I got out of that seminar was I called her and I said, "Ginger," I said, "I am an alcoholic," and I said, "I need a sponsor." And so she had me meet her here at a 5:45 the very next day. And so anyway, that night, March 17th, I picked up a white chip instead of going to get my green beer somewhere. And I've been here ever since. The thing she told me when we first met with each other after the meeting was that I really needed to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And she wanted me to read the... She worked with me through the 12 and 12. So I had to read the first step every day for 2 weeks. If I messed up, I had to start all over again. And so to get me grounded into some new habits. And so... And to not think about never drinking again, just think about don't drink one day at a time. I could wrap my brain around not drinking one day at a time. It was really hard for me to wrap my brain around never having another drink because it felt like, I mean, it was my buddy. It was my spiritual solution. It was the thing that gave me that sense of ease and comfort, although it was fleeting and it was fantasy land because, you know, in all honesty, I felt like, you know, crap after, you know, time went on. And so anyway, I commenced to coming in here every day at the 11 o'clock. And to this day, the 11 o'clock is still my home group. And so I came every day. Thank God, NABBA is just right up the road from me. At that time, I was a stay-at-home mom, so I could make the 11 o'clock every single day. And I did the 90 and 90, and I started working the steps. And after I read the first and second and third step every day, it was a period of 6 weeks because I had to do 2 weeks with each step. I went over to her house and we took a good long time and did a formal first through third step and read each step to each other and got on our knees and did the third step prayer. And then we read the fourth step and she wanted me to get ready for the fourth step. And that third step prayer saved my life. I'll go back to the second since I skipped it. I didn't have any problem with God of my understanding. When I came in here, I was right at home. It was so funny because I go to a church called Unity, and I would go to Unity, and I'd come here, and I go, wait a minute. Do I know them from NABBA or do I know them from Unity? And it comes to find out I was knowing them from both places because there's a lot of recovering alcoholics that go to that church. And at that time, our minister was a recovering alcoholic. He told his story at my third AA birthday here. And so anyway, I didn't understand the insanity part because I didn't think I was insane. Until I heard that it was doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting a different result, and I could wrap my brain around that. The third step prayer was just instrumental in those first few months because it gave me a sense of ease and comfort to, mimic those words. I memorized the prayer and to mimic those words that I would bear witness, you know, that I would be the one to heal one day at a time from this, and then I would be able to pay it forward. And that brought me so much peace because I don't know why, I just did, that I could heal from this and I'd have a message. And when I got to the fourth step, I kept screwing up my every day for 2 weeks, and I was ready to do the fourth step. A lot of people really say they lament over that. They just don't want to do the fourth step. They're afraid of the fourth step. I wanted it off my chest. I'm the type of alcoholic that was the perpetual victim, so there wasn't a whole lot of my story I hadn't shared with other people because how can you be a victim if you don't share your story, right? And you know, I told everything just so I could get, you know, have that victim role. What happened for me, though, is when I did my, when she finally let me do my fourth step because I threatened to get another sponsor. And when I did my fourth step, what happened for me was this shift in perception from victimization to, you know, having some sort of responsibility, having a role in my decisions and having a role in how I perceive things. And it helped. It helped a lot when I did the fifth step with her, that I could tell her those things and tell her in another way besides being a victim. And then when we started looking at the character defects, pride, they say in the book, the pride leads the procession. Well, pride is like the number one with me. And, you know, but all the other ones came out too, to a certain extent. And it helped me a lot to realize that character defects are character traits. And under the umbrella of fear, character traits become defective. And I didn't know that I was afraid. I didn't know that I was acting out the way I acted out because of fear. And and I guess the way I understand the shortcomings is when you are entirely ready to have your God remove your defects of character, you name them and you claim them, and then you ask to have them removed. The shortcomings are when they kind of rear their ugly head when you're not expecting it, you know. And so that brings in humility. And I've had lots of opportunities to have some humility. And I think the longer I'm in here, the more opportunities I'm having. Because what has happened for me of late is you get a excuse me, you get a little time in here, and or I do. I got a little time in here, and I started thinking that I knew things, that I didn't have to run certain things by people. And especially when it, you know, is in my immediate family. And I've had some things backfire on my butt big time because I didn't run it by somebody else. And I actually have two sponsors, but I knew better, you know. I didn't have to run it by them. And it was a big lesson. And I just had that lesson not too long ago. And talk about defects of character. And the shortcomings, and the sponsor that I spoke with about this one particular thing was, you know, going back to the 10th step. But I'm getting ahead of myself, so let's go back to 8. And what is 8? Made a list. So anyway, so I got together with my sponsor and we talked about the list. And you know, first and foremost was myself. And then my oldest daughter, because she was put through the most of my alcoholism. And my son was 3 when I came in. And I actually had another child at the ripe old age of 38. She just turned 13 in October. But so she's never seen me have a drink. Living amends has been my biggest amends. And the other amends was, that I felt was a financial amends, was to General Communications, AirTouch, Verizon. And I've had a cell phone with them since 1987. So, and I don't switch. I stay with them because I feel like that's a way to make a financial amends to them. None of the people I worked with or even with that company, the company split so many times, it's pathetic. So, and I asked, was that a good way to make a financial amends? And my sponsor agreed. So that's how I make the amends to them. And that was 9. Step 10. That has been a very key step for me, especially lately. I mean, I've always used it, but here lately, this woman has just started sponsoring me about three months ago, and she is big on step 10. And when I came to her with some of the stuff that was going on, and I just wanted to blah, 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 and she just cut me off. She goes, go to step 10, work a good step 10, find your character defects, do the 6 and 7. Step 10, go back to 6 and 7. And I didn't want to, because I don't want to see anything wrong with me. I've got almost 15 years in this program. I sponsor people. I don't want to see what's wrong with me, you know, that kind of thing, that pride. And I go to her again, step 10, 6 and 7. So I finally made her sit down with me and made her show me exactly what she meant. Because I was just so far in denial and so far out there that I couldn't see what was bringing me so much pain, you know. And one thing's for sure, just because you're sober does not mean you don't go through pain in here. Life on life's terms is still going on. And so anyway, once I finally sat in it long enough and let enough time go by and started doing those prayers every day. I mean, it was just like, it lifted. And I can, in hindsight now, I know it, every single thing happened exactly as it should have. No matter how painful it was, whatever it was I was going through, it all happened exactly the way it was supposed to happen. The main thing was, is I still kept sponsoring. I still kept coming to meetings. I still kept working with my sponsor. And I kept cleaning up and showing up and coming to meetings. And I'll tell you one thing. I double up on my meetings when I'm going through stuff. I mean, I do not rest on my laurels because I cannot stand that pain. And I know for me, if I get in enough pain and I don't do this kind of work, what the easy fix is. And I don't want to go back. I do not want to go back there. So I have what I call my recipe in step 11. And that's, and I get up every morning and I do my prayer meditation. If I own my own business now. I've had my own business now for 8 years. And so I get to, you know, make a lot of my own hours. So I can hit an 11 or an 8 or a 5:45. Or, you know, but I'll hit a meeting at NABA just almost every day. And so I hit a meeting. I do exercise. I've been walking for years, and I don't let up on that. So I try to get the mental, the physical, and then, you know, and get my medicine, which is AA. And I started sponsoring women probably in my third year of sobriety. And I have a lot of sponsees. I don't even know how many. I don't count because it scares me. I cannot tell you that most of these women, I would have never crossed their path. Never. If it hadn't been for AA. And I always get choked up when I talk about working with others, because that is the meat of this program. Because any kind, when I'm on a step with another sponsee, I'm on that step too. They're on it, but I'm on it too. It keeps it fresh for me. It keeps everything fresh for me. And I had a lot of people ask me to sponsor before I was 3 years sober, and we had, you know, little times of some never called me again, and some maybe a couple of weeks. But I started getting real people to work with at when I was 3 years old in here. And I have one lady that I've been with for going on 9 years now, and pretty much since she walked in the doors. And you don't have that kind of, you don't just get those kind of relationships just out of the blue. I can count only 3 friends that I've had since childhood. And I have people in here that I see almost every single day. I talk to weekly. And it's a real relationship. I mean, it's heartfelt. We talk to each other about life on life's terms. We work the steps. I've had an opportunity to do a lot of service work. I had the Friday 11 o'clock meeting. My first sponsor died. She used to sit over there in that chair where that guy is. The green shirt on. Her name was Beverly. And she never missed an 11 o'clock meeting ever that I could remember until she started getting sick. She was in her 80s. And she started getting really sick. And so when she died, I took that 11 o'clock meeting on, and I did it for at least 3 years. And I have had an opportunity to serve at NABA. And I know NABA is not AA, but this clubhouse is and was erected, especially, you know, particularly for people in AA and Al-Anon to recover. So this is a special place to me. I mean, I cannot tell you you know, what this place means to me. So what it's like now is, you know, it's life on life's terms. I do have joy in my life. I have that joy in my life too. I love you, Joy. And but I do have joy in my life. And I have, a great family, a great husband. We've been together 19 years now. And been in the same house for 19 years. I haven't had to have geographical cures. I haven't had to, decide that this is not a good way to live and go back out and pick up another white chip. This is a really, really good way to live. And so, anyway, I think that's probably all I have. I don't know. And I'm finishing just on time, right on time. So, anyway, thank you all. I'm sorry this was so impromptu, but thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Debbie. That was AA amazing. Definitely. Thank you for coming through. Mark Holmes is going to hand out the chips.
My name is Mark, an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
White chips for those who want to take this way of living one day at a time, want to pick a white chip. All right. Okay, we have a silver chip for 30 days, red chip for 90 days, yellow chip for 6 months, green chip for 9 months. All right, we have a blue chip for your multiples. See, we got a special chip here.
Mark's a sponsee of Tim's. I am too. Terry back here is. And Tim works with a lot of great guys. He's got 9 years today. And that was his cake. So I'm glad everybody enjoyed it. I don't know where I'd be if it wasn't for Tim. He's been involved in this speaker's meeting, for about 8 years now. And it's working out for him. It's working out for us. So I want to thank you, Tim. Chip from the Monday Night Blue Chip speaker.
Thank you, Tim. And Tim, I'm an alcoholic. This is 9 years. Thank you very much. Thank you, Debbie. You're my hero. And you know I mean that. I love you. And you told your story last year on my birthday. So you should have. That's great. But I appreciate what Tim does for this meeting. I just show up now. But Tim does all the heavy lifting. But, you know, I see a lot of new people here. And I was telling somebody this week, Harry, I know you understand this. I guess you do, but it's kind of like when you see somebody every day, you don't see the changes in them that much unless you see a picture of them the way they were when they got here or years ago. And that's, you know, when I stop now and you reflect on your birthdays and I think about what life was like and how chaotic it was and crazy it was, just crazy and insane. And it's changed because I didn't drink and I came to meetings and I reached out and talked to people. And if you are new, I promise you there are people, lots of people at NAVA that will not judge you, that will listen to you, that will be long-suffering. And I hear stories about people where they tell you to shut up and listen. I never experienced that at NAVA. I mean, from the first day I came here, I felt like you really needed me and I was important. And you sold me on it somehow, you know. But and I met my wife in this room. Now, it doesn't happen this way for everybody, but I met my wife in this room after being single 12 years. And we're very happy. I was, when I was about 2 months sober, I was sitting back there, and Bobby Jones, the one and only, was picking up his 17-year chip. And he talked about he had just got a pardon from the governor for some felonies. And I was about, maybe just a few weeks ago, I thought, man, wouldn't it be something if one day I could get a pardon? And fast forward about 5 or 6 years, I got a pardon from the governor. And that's how I got the job where I work now. And amazing things do happen here. They really, it's not just something that every now and then, it really does. And I just encourage you to stick around. And thanks, everybody, for coming. And let Debbie love you. Thanks, everybody, for helping me out. So.
Does anyone want to reconsider Whitesville? Happy birthday, Tim. Anniversary. And give yourself a hand for the chips you got.
Thank you, Mark. Great job. Okay, now it's time for AA-related announcements. Now the club announcements would be nice, too.
Yes.
Hey, it's Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tinsley.
On Saturday the 21st, we're having a coffee house here with live music and barbecue this time. And there's some tickets available tonight. And Tim, I believe you have tickets, right?
I do. Yes, indeed.
It's going to be a great time. That's Saturday the 21st after the coffee meeting.
Yeah, those advanced tickets are only $5, $7 at the door. It's a really great deal. We're going to have some fantastic talent. Yours truly is going to open the show and close the show. So. And the barbecue is coming from Manuel's Tavern. So. Yes.
My name is Mark, an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
I'm Mark. I have a teacher ministry captain. Anyone would like an 8 minutes to see me after the meeting?
Get your literature from Mark.
Yes. Bill Ritz's 55th birthday celebration will be this Friday night at Four Cross First United Methodist at 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock Friday night, Bill Ritz picks up a 55-year chip. Next week we've got Owen J. He came here from Buford, South Carolina, a low country kind of guy. A low country, low bottom, and he's involved in the spiritual kindergarten on Friday nights here, and he tells a great story. This will be his second time at the podium, and then the week after that, David T. from the Big Book Bunch across the expressway at the Unitarian Church. He's going to be telling his story. We have a good lineup for the next few weeks, actually. So please come and stay sober with us. If there are no further announcements, I remind you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join hand in the Lord's Prayer. Brian M., would you take us out, please, sir?
Let's have a moment of silence. About those inside and outside this circle that are suffering. It's all about you.
Da 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 da.